Hey Podnuts, Corey here from Instant House Call. Whether you're a break fix tech who needs to provide remote support on demand without pre-installed software, or a managed service provider who wants to connect to unattended PCs anytime, Instant House Call makes remote support easy. I want to invite you to try Instant House Call free for yourself. Go to podnuts.com and click on the link in the show notes, then use the promo code PODNUTS. Instant House Call is the best remote support on earth. We can prove it. Try it free now and see for yourself.
Welcome to PodNuts Daily, episode number 400, a show for computer repair techs by computer repair techs. I am your host, Jeff Halish. I'm joined today by Yohai Gall from BostonTechCollective.com. How you doing, Yohai?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Very good. Hey, it's good to have you on the show, and I know you've got a very interesting business that I was checking out. Somebody had sent me a link and said, hey, check these guys out and see what they're doing. So very interested to hear all the different things that you guys are doing in your business to make it work for you. Let's start here. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're located, and basically how you got started in computer repair.
Sure. So my name is Yochai. I'm actually from California originally, but I currently live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I started doing IT repair. I must have been around 17. My dad has a small copier repair business in California, and there's some translation there. So I grew up sort of around that environment. And, you know, just like most guys my age, I played video games and broke computers and sort of taught myself. And then when I entered community college, I decided to get more serious about it. And I started doing sort of ad hoc work for a company out in San Luis Obispo, California. I eventually moved to San Francisco, where I was doing similar work for a nonprofit that I just sort of fell into. I did that for about 5 years until I got kind of sick of the in-house IT game, and I came up with this crazy idea to start sort of a IT repair business that was owned and run by its employees. So the first, our opening day was around May of 2007, and that was in San Francisco. We still have an office there, so we actually are a bi-coastal business, but we're more managed independently, and I can explain that, I guess, in a little bit. But basically, I started this worker-owned cooperative, as it's called, which is basically a business that's owned and run by its employees democratically. In San Francisco, they are still up and running, and they're still doing quite well for themselves, both financially and I guess individually, a lot of the original people are still there. And eventually, my now wife decided she wanted to move back to her homeland of Massachusetts.
Okay.
So I followed her. And after working in a sort of corporate gig for a couple of years, I felt the calling yet again. And last April, opened a second worker cooperative based on the first one, but with about some minor differences, but overall the same business model, same logo. We even share the same email system with the first branch. We share the same wiki. We do not share finances. We're actually managed independently, but we're very tightly wound or tightly integrated company. I speak to my counterpart over there pretty much 5 times a day. So
okay.
Still very, very tight relationship with them. And we're actually working on creating an even tighter one. And I can talk about that later. But so opened up another co-op here in the Boston area. Found other IT worker types on Reddit, Craigslist. There's actually a listserv for IT co-ops. And I don't have it offhand, but I can give it to you in a bit if you want to put it somewhere. But there's actually a listserv where if you're interested in this sort of thing, you can actually go and sign up and be on the email list or just ask questions or whatever you want. And I actually posted saying, hey, I'm starting another one of these. Who knows someone? And one of the founders of this co-op actually responded to me there. Did a bunch of interviews, did a bunch of training. And then as of May 1st last year, we opened. So we've been open for about a year and a few months in this area. But the original co-op has been running since 2007. So
okay,
that's kind of the story.
Oh, I was going to say that's a great story. In most businesses, I would say people would say that you can't have more than one owner. To run something democratically like that would be difficult. But you've found a way to not only do it once, but twice, and have it up and running and working.
Yeah, our plan is actually to do it more than twice. Okay. That's kind of what we're working on now. But to give you sort of an idea of the difficulties, it is hard to run a business the way we run it. I would say it's no harder than running a regular business. It's just different.
Okay.
One thing a lot of people don't understand about worker cooperatives is it's not like we sit around and every decision has to be made democratically. We agree on a set of rules and we all follow those rules. I don't need to check with my coworkers if my decision is going to fall under the purview of the power that I've been provided with. So, for example, if I decide, hey, I want to start selling clients this device for this margin and it's going to work this way, I don't have to ask anybody. I mean, I should tell them because they're probably going to run into it and be like, hey, WTF, why is this in our inventory and why is it not, et cetera. It's in my best and their best interest to be communicative, but I don't have to ask them. If I go out and decide to spend $500 on a device that's just for me in my office for like my desk, like, if I buy a laptop for myself,
right,
and I don't talk to them about it, then that violates one of our rules, which is that any purchase over $300 have to be sort of validated by your coworkers either when it happens or at one of our meetings. So it's actually much more flexible than you might imagine.
Okay.
One thing about it is that I think most IT consultants have in them a strong sense of individualism and sort of doing things their own way, and also on the positive side, they have a lot of momentum. I think a lot of IT consultants are willing to spend hours and hours to achieve their goals and teach themselves and they have great qualities for being an owner. What a lot of us don't have is good communication skills and good sort of personal skills where you can listen to another person when they need to be listened to and where you can communicate with the person in the way that they can understand. I think a lot of us are lacking those skills, including myself. I still suck at that stuff. But what working at the co-op has taught me is sort of how to be a better technician as well as being just a better person, a better professional. Because I get to learn from others without the feeling of I better do what they say, otherwise I'll be fired, or I better do what they say even if I don't agree with it. I'm able to sort of stand up and say, I don't agree with that, and I don't want to do things that way. And you know what? In some cases, I get outvoted and I don't get my way. And in some cases, that happens and I realize that I was wrong. And holy crap, like, here's a great example. We decided to move our website to Squarespace, even though we have an in-house web developer, because our web developer was so stretched. He was so busy with doing other stuff and various projects that we're working on that he just didn't feel like doing what was necessary to keep our website dynamic and interesting. On the other hand, one of our other techs is a great designer and knows Squarespace really well. And I fought against it. I said, this is dumb. We should go with building our WordPress site because that's what you know. And it can be the same as Squarespace and all the problems I have with Squarespace, et cetera. And I voted against it, but they were all for going to Squarespace. And you know what? The guy who knows it prevailed and was able to sort of show his skill set. I think that given the results of that argument, I was good that I lost. And so I guess that's just an example. Like, sometimes it's good to lose and you learn from it. And I think if you were just one boss and you're, sort of overseeing a group of technicians underneath you, you'll never be in that situation. You'll never let yourself be in a situation where you can learn from one of your other technicians. I mean, I guess you could, but it wouldn't come up organically the way that it does within a co-op. So that's one of the great things about it, is that even when you're wrong, you can still benefit.
Well, absolutely, because I think one of those things that you can either learn the hard way, and you could have, just stuck with what you were doing. But when you have somebody else that can, pour into you and say, well, here's the reasons why I think we should do it this way. And, a lot of times to me, it would stop that pain of having to learn something the hard way. And, you know, I get asked a lot of times, even doing this show, they're like, well, why would computer technicians want to share what they know with other computer technicians? And it's like,
have they heard of open source software?
You guys just don't understand how communities work.
Right.
And it's like, even if I have a so-called competitor, which I don't believe in competitors, but if I had a so-called competitor in my city or town or whatever, I look at my area and I go, okay, I'm in a 6x6 square mile radius. I have 93,000 people. I'm not really worried about competition.
Right. Right. For people like us. Yeah. I'm basically on the same page as you as far as like what is competition for me. If there is competition, that's actually great. If there is another business that does what we do, I'm happy. First off, I can copy from them.
Right.
Second, I can learn to be better than them.
Right.
And then third, in general, competition breeds better quality products for the consumer, and absolutely. I'm for that. So, yeah, I think
that's
people
true.
Don't
yeah.
they don't understand that there's a community I think that's just sort of built into people who run in our circles. Like, we want to share. You know why? Because it's a source of frustration and inspiration. Every single day, I'll tell my coworker, oh, you know what BS I had to deal with? And then he'll be like, oh, backup exec or, you know, something. You know, we have these sessions of stuff every day and it feels great. And then you know what? It usually leads to someone telling me, hey, why don't we try this next time? And I gain from that. So why would that not work on a national level or on an internet level?
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, that's good. It's good to have that, you know, that camaraderie. You know, I explain to a lot of people too. A lot of people that when, you know, doing this show, it's basically like two guys sitting in a garage, you know, drinking an iced tea or whatever, and just kind of telling about their day. And, you know, a lot of times, my wife is great, but she could really not care too much about, you know, all the technical stuff that I have to go through on a daily basis. So, you know, I don't want to bore her to tears when I can talk to another technician and go, yeah, this happened to me and this is what I did. And they go, oh, I had to happen and I did this. And and you're like, oh yeah, I guess I could have tried that and I didn't, you know? So you kind of, it's always a learning experience. And then you just, time to kind of unwind.
Right. Right. I try to tell my wife about these things, and first I have to explain how it works,
right?
Because she doesn't have the background, just like I don't have a background in what she does,
right?
And then I have to get her to give a crap,
right?
So I can still call my dad. Worst comes to worst, and even if he doesn't totally understand it, he has enough of a tech mind where he can say, "Yeah, that I get why you're annoyed," and that's kind of
right.
That is nice, but I feel like this industry specifically. Because of the sort of fragmented proprietary nature of a lot of small business IT, whether it's the, you know, proprietary sales software they use or the auto repair software they use or the insurance software they use, there's stuff that happens that you either won't find anything about it on the internet or you won't know anyone who's dealt with it before. And honestly, that's a disservice. In my opinion, not spreading anything you can learn about those products is a disservice to everyone else in the industry. Because you know what? I don't care if it's even a competitor of mine. I don't want anyone to have to live through the BS that I had to live through with some of this software. And being able to pass that on is both cathartic for me, but also I think helpful for the community in general.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know we were talking about before the show and you were saying that you guys have a wiki that has tips in it on different things that you've run across, and you kind of provide that information that, you know, people can look at and go, hey, if you ever run across this weird issue that, you know, there's probably only a handful of people in the whole world that will run into, then you can check this out and, you know, I'll put the information online for you. So, and we were also talking before, you know, one of the irritations everybody knows of forums is that a lot of times you get out of the one answer that was good, you have 19 answers that were just like, why did you even spend your time to put something on there? I don't understand. But anyways, so.
Well, yeah, and about that wiki, We actually share that with our branch in San Francisco, so we benefit from their experience as well.
Oh, and there you go.
We recently opened it up. There's a worker cooperative that's also an IT company that actually is much older than ours, based out of New Orleans, called C4 Tech, like C4, the explosive.
Right, okay.
And they've been around, I want to say, for 10 years.
Okay.
And they have, if I remember last count, it's like 14 or 15 co-owners. And what's interesting about them is they actually model themselves a little differently than we do, but we have a technician exchange with them where we'll actually send a tech out to them and vice versa for a full week. And that person will shadow one of our employees of a similar job and learn from us, and we'll learn from them. And we've gained from it. I mean, we've learned so much about their processes and then adopted those processes here in the Boston area and also in San Francisco that we actually are now building a little sort of movement of IT shops that are worker-owned businesses so that we can start doing this with even more companies around the country. So we're talking to a company out in Madison, Wisconsin about something very similar, maybe building a sort of federation of tech co-ops that can both share knowledge either with our wiki or by sharing technicians, or, and this is kind of the thing we're really aiming for, we're trying to figure out a way to scale but still remain independent. So for example, if we can all agree on purchasing under one moniker, let's say we want to resell an antivirus license. Let's say we want to start selling antivirus licenses from a certain product, like ESET Nod32 or Kaspersky or something. What we could do theoretically is do it all under one company name, and it'll look like we have way more purchases than all the individual companies have. So then when we purchase that actual license and resell it, we're purchasing it for a lot less, because the more you sell, the less it costs you. I mean, right. That's how it works for some of these. So that's actually one model that we're working on right now, is building on a legal and then technical level a federation of worker-owned IT businesses that can basically compete at scale with other MSPs and small IT companies for things like, hey, when I purchase from Newegg, I want better terms. I want net 30 terms, so I have more time to pay them back. And if I purchase under – if we have a way more purchases, we'll get that kind of those terms. So that's just a smidgen of what we're kind of looking at now. And what's nice about the co-op world is that this kind of thinking is sort of ingrained in how we operate. So it's really easy to convince, let's say, a group of guys or men and women over at another IT co-op to do what we want to do, because they already understand that knowledge sharing is very powerful, and that working together can actually strengthen the all the individuals as a whole. So, yeah, that's my spiel.
Yeah, that's great. That's just using the power of many, and again, it's a group effort, and it's neat that you can, you know, work with other groups and kind of pull everything that, and that's, I mean, I would have never thought about that, swapping workers for a week to get all that information and just, you know, helping each other. And obviously you're in two, you know, different areas.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not, it's not really close competition necessarily.
Yeah, but not at all. But in fact, what we've ended up doing in a couple instances is sending each other work. You know, if, for example, the New Orleans co-op has a pretty strong web team. So my co-op doesn't do that much sort of like shopping cart web development. And if we have a client who asks about it, I can point them in that direction, and I can either, you know, get some money back from that or just help another co-op, which, you know, they'll end up helping me later, so why not? So that's come up a number of times, especially with our West Coast branch. But we're trying to sort of build a model that lets small businesses, especially ones like ours, basically get the same benefits that some of the large businesses that which frankly suck.
Right.
Joy.
Yeah. So now, so if you were going, and I know you plan on expanding, would you say it was fairly easy to set this up? Or, I mean, I know you said you'd put out some feelers to find some other, you know, techs on Craigslist and different things that, you know, maybe you would interview and you wanted to do what you were doing. Was it a long process to get that done, or I mean, how long did it take? Yeah.
The second time around, well, so the first time it was hard. I spent a full year preparing. Fortunately, the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, has a pretty strong technical support group for worker cooperatives because there's a ton out there.
Okay.
It's called the Network of Bay Area Worker Cooperatives, or NOBOS.
Nice. I like that.
Yes, very clever. So they helped me out sort of in figuring out how it would work on a legal level, which at the time, you know, I didn't know anything. I was, at the time, I was 24 or 23.
Okay.
And that took a while. We also had no money. So eventually, what I actually did is I went and, this is a little bit unethical, I started working at this pretty renowned computer shop that treated their employees pretty poorly, but you know, they sold pretty good inventory. Anyways, I worked there for about 6 months and left with five of their employees to start this business. Yeah. It actually didn't happen. I wasn't trying to be nefarious. Like, I thought, oh, I'll get some experience. I might meet some people there.
Right.
And then they just treated me so bad that I was just like, well, F them. So I left with a bunch of their people. And we started. We took out a $20,000 line of credit from Wells Fargo. And at the time, the interest rates was pretty good. This was, you know, pre-economic collapse.
Right.
So, okay. So that was, you know, that was actually, we worked hard and we paid ourselves really low at the time. Now, you know, techs there make so much more than we made when we started. Actually, it's actually pretty impressive what they make now compared to what similar jobs in that area make, especially given the fact that most people hate their jobs. And so,
right.
Anyways, when I moved out here, I thought, okay, I'm going to do it right. I started planning in November and we opened in May. So it took about that long to find people, get them trained, set up the business. The hard thing was I wanted to pay people what they deserve and not, you know, when you start a business, if you're by yourself, you're paying yourself crap. And that's how right. It always works. And that's why a lot of business owners legitimately feel ire when they hear about things like, you know, paying employees more, because they think to themselves, oh, you know, I don't pay myself anything. And fine, there's an argument to be had there. But what's nice about a worker co-op is we can all set our wages to whatever we think is reasonable. And we don't pay each other the same. We get paid different depending on our jobs. That's not the same. That's not true everywhere, but that's how it is for us.
Okay.
So we wanted to be able to pay ourselves what the industry would pay in order to get good technicians, basically. So what we decided to do was get a loan. And there's a group here called the Co-op Federation of New England, or the Cooperative Federation. Oh, I'm sorry, the Co-op Federation of New England. And what they do is they provide loans to worker cooperatives. And they gave us $70,000 loan to start this business. And that was enough for us to pay ourselves well and to buy everything we needed. And we, you know, it lasted about 7 or 8 months, which is what we expected. We started paying it off in January of this year, and it's going fine. Hopefully we'll have it fully paid off by the end of next year. It would be pretty great.
Nice.
So that's okay. Basically how we're still trying to pay ourselves well. We haven't we actually adjusted a couple things because we realized we paid some people too much and some people too little, but that's
okay.
Part of the learning business, especially in a new area. And I learned a lot from that experience, just sort of like seeing how Boston is compared to San Francisco. Long story short, it is not easy to start a business, as I'm sure everyone who listens to this podcast knows. It is easier to start it with others. Even if there are some personality issues, and there will be personality issues, just being able to know that you're not alone, that if something comes up, either you can get bailed out or you can ask someone for help. And that is so different than when I did this independently when I was younger, that the feeling of just being stressed out all the time, everything is – the whole world's on my shoulders. I don't know how to think about it. We have a guy here who does our IT, a guy here who does our, you know, admin office stuff. We have a person here who does hardware. We have someone else who does the website stuff. I don't have to do everything. I just do what I do well, which is basically, you know, business support and Linux administration and data recovery. I get to do the stuff that I enjoy. And while I'm still responsible for the whole business, just like everyone else here, I don't have to think about it. And that to me is massive compared to being a straight up independent business owner. And I strongly suggest people consider that benefit when they look into starting a new business, is doing it with others. in my mind, is easier than doing it alone.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mentioned this even before the show, is that, you know, sometimes we feel like we're just isolated out here by ourselves and we have nobody that we can, you know, ask a question or, you know, get some information from, or, you know, and again, it's one of the reasons that we do this show is so that we can share that type of information between other techs. And hopefully, you know, people that are just starting out or even people that have been in business for a while will get something out of this. I know back in the day when I was listening to this show before I was hosting it, it didn't matter if you were a brand new tech that came on the show or if you were a tech that had been in the business for 20 plus years. I learned something from everybody. And whenever I ran across a situation where I go, hey, so-and-so talked about this on a podcast, I remember this situation, and instead of me having to take all the time and effort to research it myself, I was able to go find a solution real quick, take care of it, and I was on my way. And so the benefit of that, yeah, I can definitely see where we're partnering with other people would be a great benefit versus, you know, just standing out here by yourself going, I don't know how to do that. How am I going to figure that out? You know, and you spend a lot of time and a lot of money to try to figure those things out sometimes. And that's the pain in the process. So I can see where it might be a little bit easier with a group of people.
Right. And we're also lucky enough that we have an organization like the Cooperative Fund of New England to sort of, you know, if some of us may have had, let's say, no credit, they look the other way and look at they do, like, you know, intense interviews, and they're very upfront about it, but they kind of give you a chance just because they want to support co-ops more than they would if you were just by yourself. I'm not saying, oh, it's easier to get money if you're a co-op. I'm saying if the infrastructure is around, it's an additional option if that's what you need. So that is one other benefit, is that there are organizations that are dedicated to helping this sort of business structure, which is probably seems unusual to most of your listeners, since few people in the U.S. actually know what a worker cooperative is, but there is actually quite a community of businesses that do what we do, or that are organized as we are, enough so that we are lucky enough to have a few different funds around the country that help provide loan or even grants to start worker-owned businesses.
Oh, that's great. To be honest with you, I had never heard of a worker cooperative before until somebody sent me an email about a week ago and said, hey, check these guys out over here. They're doing something that's pretty cool. And I said, okay, well, I'll check it out. And I went to your website, and, you know, I'm looking at your website now, and I did not realize, number one, that it was a Squarespace site. It's a beautiful site. It's simplistic, but yet has all the information that I think a person would need right from the get-go.
I actually take that as a compliment, because some of the info is from me, but the on behalf of the guy who actually designed the site, Charlie, that's his skill. His skill is taking complicated information and making anyone understand it, whether they're a tech person or a non-tech person. And it's you can see it with his clients. He deals with a lot of our home clients. They do that thing that they'll never do for me, where they say, I love Charlie. They'll say, I love Charlie. I've never had someone say, I love Yochai. But I hear people call here. It's unbelievable. And, you know, he actually left. He was working for a similar business for, I think, 10 years doing the same thing. And he was quite unhappy there for a number of reasons. And when he came here, he didn't proselytize. He didn't tell his clients, hey, come over to my new business. He just told them where he was going because they asked. And we got a lot of business from that, just because of how popular he was. People just wanted him. They didn't even care about the company. They just wanted him. And that's a strength, I think, of our model, is that we can let certain personalities shine, and we can let them do what they do best, because we give them an avenue to do that, because they feel sort of able to say, hey, you know, I think it would be cool if we did this. And that's actually some of our more successful business models here have come from one of us saying, you know, I could probably research this specific technology and we could start implementing that, and it might make us some money. And we've hit a lot of home runs and some failures, but we've hit a lot of home runs with that kind of mentality. And I think the website, even though it doesn't, you know, doesn't make us money directly, it's a symbol of that, because it wouldn't have happened in another environment. He wouldn't have been doing that. He would have been doing what he does on a day-to-day basis, which is IT support, working for some company who frankly did not have a very good website. And he would talk to them on a regular basis about how they could spruce things up, whether it's on design level or on the services that they offer. And they just basically ignored him. When here we give him relatively free rein, and he feels empowered to sort of do what's interesting to him, and as long as, you know, it doesn't harm the business, and as long as it hopefully helps us make some money in the end, we're sort of for it. Obviously, we talk about these sort of things ahead of time, but I think that our website, and I am really proud of it, even though I didn't design it, our website is a symbol of that. It was a choice that other businesses would not have provided their technicians, and I feel like that's really great, I guess. And I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to say we're the best thing in the freaking world, but I'm particularly proud of how that worked out, especially since I was so wrong about it.
You know, I've never understood why people will not listen to other people, whether, you know, they're working for you or not. If somebody's got a good idea, I've always been that way. If somebody's got a better idea than what I've got, I'm more than willing to listen to them. And so that they, you know, hey, you want to do that? Yeah, go ahead and go for it. Let's see what we can do. It just makes a lot more sense to be able to you know, just have that other mindset, because I think of things in one, you know, one track, and I don't always think outside of that. I try to, but I'm not always really good at it. So I have to look to others to be able to, you know, to be able to do that, so that we can expand that information.
Well, we're all susceptible to tunnel vision in this industry, and I'm 100% a victim of my own tunnel vision on a regular basis. And having someone come over to me and say, "Hey, Yochai, you got to step back, man," and it does make a difference. You know, we do regular reviews of our members at the co-op. So we basically sit someone down, tell them what we think about how they're doing, and get feedback and that kind of thing, as a sort of reinforcement mechanism to produce the best possible workers and best and happiest workers. And one thing that I always have seen come up is, you do a good job, but sometimes you just only focus on just like fixing that stupid problem, and not just on what you should be focusing on, which is, you know, making the customer happy or that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's definitely, I'm 100% as susceptible to it as anyone else. I can tell you though, Jeff, that if you are able to take criticism and to listen to other people and to learn from them, you'd probably be a pretty good boss, because that's the best bosses I've ever had have been the ones who listen to you. But I feel like in our industry, the qualities that tend to come with our personality types that gravitate towards this industry, they don't have that skill set usually. I certainly did not, and I'm still struggling with it. So I feel like the co-op, I would have become one of those bosses or one of those managers who do exactly what I hate. I think the model can exacerbate your best and worst qualities. And when you're sort of, I don't know, when you're put in a certain position of power, I think unless it's checked by someone else on a regular basis, like it is here, it's easy to lose sight of what's important. So I'm not trying to pontificate too much. I totally agree with what you said.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's good stuff. Hey, I want to take a quick break here. We're going to do a commercial. Just want to let you guys know today's episode is brought to you by D72. It is the ultimate PC technician's repair tool designed to automate your daily workload and dramatically increase your efficiency and ultimately your bottom line. D72 provides automation for system information gathering and custom reporting. It does virus and malware removal, Windows repair, and comprehensive maintenance, basic tweaking and app installations, data backup, keeps all your favorite tools updated, which is a big plus for me because I know I'm tired of updating my tools on my USB thumb drive all the time. It keeps your configuration and definition synced in the cloud. It has integration with your PSA, CRM, or ticket tracking software. And some of the things that have come up, they're new lately. It's got new and simple descriptive interface for viewing and reacting to system alerts, and also for running internal functions. In other words, it's stuff that you can read a lot easier and know exactly what it does instead of going, I've heard of that thing before, but I'm not sure exactly how it works. You can also build custom HTML reports with your pre-configured templates. You can customize apps or system alerts, which are automatically logged as you work within D72. One of the features I've been using a lot lately is the reports. you know, when it lets me know that there's a, you know, all the reports that get done at the end, it can email them to me, or I can look at them right on that machine that I'm working on. It works beautifully. You can also reorder all D72 functions, mixing and matching them with custom apps in your predefined auto mode routines. So if you want to run things in a certain order, your way, you can do that now. It's not fixed. And Nick is always adding great new features. D72, automate, relax, get paid. Head on over to foolishit.com and use the offer code PODNUTS20. And I just want to thank Nick Shaw for supporting this show today. All right, so I think we've covered co-ops.
yeah, sorry about that.
No, it's been great. No, I love the information because I was totally unaware until I ran, you know, like I said, somebody sent me an email and I checked you guys out. I think it's great. And I think that particular bit of information is going to help a lot of people, especially people that are going, hey, is this something I want to do? Is this something I want to continue as a one-man shop? Or do I want to get together with a couple people and use our combined strengths to really make a great business?
Well, if that's something that any of your listeners are ever interested in, please contact me. I can help.
Okay, great. That's awesome. So, I'm looking at your website now. Yeah. Like I said, you know, really, really great, simplified website. Yeah, I might have to talk to you guys. I might have to talk. Who'd you say it was? Charlie?
Charlie. Yeah. He's actually doing, we're in the midst of revamping our first branch's website with the same, we're having him do it because they're the same situation as us. They're super stretched and busy and you know, they don't have, they're not lucky enough to have a guy like Charlie in-house, so he's going to start doing work for them to get them on board with the same sort of platform. So yeah, we're definitely willing to help others in that regard.
Awesome. Well, that's great. So now from your aspect of the business, you said you dealt with mostly business and Linux support. Is that correct?
Yeah. So my background is in, first off, I'm a Linux systems administrator. I also do Windows administration. Okay. I'm not like a exchange master, but but I can do about 90% of what a small domain would require. Most of what I do is finding, I would say, non-local server solutions to people's problems, whether that's using Google Apps as opposed to hosted or local Exchange. So I do a lot of web and cloud services stuff. I do Linux systems administration, and I do data recovery, which is mostly on Linux, but it requires OS X and Windows as well. I mean, I am a Windows sysadmin. That's my original background.
Okay.
I got into Linux probably 8 years ago, and it is my primary tool, but I work with whatever's the best tool for the job. So,
yeah. Absolutely. I agree. I like Windows. Okay, I've always been a Windows guy. One of the big reasons I'm a Windows guy is because it's always worked for me, and I'm a gamer. So being a gamer, it's what I have to use.
No,
so,
I totally understand. the only thing I can say to that is I don't dual boot anymore because in the last year we have about 750 games on Steam for Linux. So I'm pretty freaking excited about probably sometime next year I'll build a full-fledged Steam OS box.
And okay.
I'll be very happy with, I 100% understand what you're saying. I just am at this point now, like I enjoy the customization capabilities that Linux provides. That honestly, I'm one of those guys that I can last maybe 3 months with my interface looking a certain way and then I have to change everything. It's just how I am. So, Charlie, for example, who I respect tremendously for his IT knowledge, he uses whatever is in front of him. He has a Chromebook, an iPad, and a Windows 10 machine, and that's his daily driver. So whatever works for you, you know.
Well, you said it. You took the words right out of my mouth. Exactly, and that's my feeling in this. In doing this stuff is that use whatever's going to work for you for that job. I mean, I have a Nexus 7 tablet. I love my Nexus 7 tablet. I have an Android phone. I love my Android phone. I'm a Windows desktop guy. I love my Windows. I do play around with Linux and stuff every once in a while, but the funny thing is I use a lot of Linux tools to do the stuff that I do, you know, to fix computers. I have to.
Right, of course. Yeah, you know, exactly. So, like our data recovery, for example, is completely in Linux because it's much more robust at handling failing hardware. So failing hard drives, for example, if I'm dealing with a drive that's failing and I use Windows, in my experience, there's a higher chance that I will get a BSOD for reasons I can't explain.
Right.
And that's pretty much, I've had maybe one kernel panic in the 3,000 drives I've recovered in the last couple of years. So I generally prefer Linux for any sort of really careful and low level support or recovery. So if I'm doing like, I'll even run a Windows file system recovery tool in Wine as opposed to running it in Windows, because I can manipulate disk images in a way that is a little easier for me in Linux, since I can basically script and automate things. You can do that in Windows as well. I feel though that, and this is again just me, the tools available to me for low-level operations are more robust in their Linux implementations. So I can be as specific as say something like, if I want to zero out one array in the master file table of an NTFS file system, I can do that in a way that is easy in Linux. And in Windows, I can do it too, but it might require 3 or 4 GUIs, or there might be some Visual Basic script someone wrote, but it's not really flexible, and the tools just exist in Linux. So for some things, it is definitely the best tool.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other shows I do is actually called My Hard Drive Died with Scott Moulton, who's a hard drive expert. He teaches hard drive forensics, hard drive recovery from, you know, tearing apart hard drives, putting them back together, getting them all linked back up, RAID recovery, which was the show we did last week. And we were talking about some of these same tools. You know, one of the Linux tools he brought up was DD Rescue.
Damn straight. DD Rescue it's an amazing piece of software. We are blessed to have it, which, by the way, you can run DD Rescue in Windows.
Yes.
Let's just point that out.
Yep, absolutely. But it's a great Linux tool. And I was looking at it and I'm like going, you know, I was telling him that I use like Acronis for, you know, my disk images and stuff like that, which is fine. But he pointed me to a free imager, FTK imager, that grabs that raw file or that raw data file. And anybody can take that once they make that image and manipulate it. You can do it in OSX, Linux, Windows. Right. It doesn't matter. And I'm like, that's a beautiful, beautiful tool.
Yeah, I mean, those things exist. And in fact, there are some tools for data recovery that are better implemented in Windows. I don't use them that often, but there are some that I'll be like, you know what? I'm just going to switch to the Windows data recovery machine for a minute because this drive is healthy and I need to manipulate this image, and it might just be easier for me to do it over there. But one thing that I love is I can sit on my Linux machine, I can take an image of a failing drive, grab the whole thing, I can mount a file system within that image in 2 command line operations and have someone's data sent over to some other drive elsewhere in the shop or attached directly. And it's just, I can do all this in 4 lines using 3 tools that are all free. I mean, that's the kind of environment that I love to work in, is with tools that are free that honestly, a lot of the stuff that is free, we donate to. I'll put a shout out here to Parted Magic, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with.
Yep.
Part of Magic, that the guy who makes that stuff, that distro, he does that for his full-time job, and it is, as an example from a data recovery perspective of how great it is, it comes with a version of the package NTFS progs, which is how you manipulate NTFS file systems in Linux. It comes with a version that is compiled with an option called NTFS truncate, which does not come in most distros. Implementations of that package. And NTFS truncate lets you do cool things like zero out a certain array in a MFT. So if I need to get rid of a master file table's record of a bad block, I can do it in 3 seconds using NTFS truncate, or I can run check disk with the B flag. And that takes 3 freaking hours. So the difference is palpable in that case. And I really love that piece of software, and I highly recommend people pay to support it because it's fantastic.
Oh, no, that's great. I'll tell you what. Yeah, there's yeah, again, it's what tools will work better for the situation that you're in. And that's, you know, I mean, I've used Linux tools for a long time just in, you know, day-to-day operations. But I'm really learning a lot about, you know, I'm used to doing things in Windows when it comes to things like, you know, scans and stuff like that. And it's like, I'm looking at this stuff, you know, like Acronis, everybody knows this. And it took me a while to realize it. If there's errors on the drive, Acronis will stop. It'll go, I can't do it. Sorry. Now, if you take something like FTK Imager, that will sit there and go, and you know, it'll take the raw data, no matter what it is, good, bad, or indifferent. And then you can take that image and go ahead and manipulate it and do what you need to do without destroying, you know, or at least having that backup.
Right, which is what DD Rescue does. Right,
right.
I would say this to anyone who's interested in dabbling in data recovery, and I'm sure everyone here has. The very first thing you should do before ever mounting a file system, at least if you have it in your shop. I guess if you're on site, it's a little harder. But if you have someone bring something into you, if you have a machine, the first thing you should do is smart test that thing. And smart isn't 100%, but I capture probably 60%. Of my failed drives by smart testing, and I can look at the attributes and I can tell a client with pretty high accuracy whether I'll be able to recover their data or whether they'll have to go to a clean room data recovery place. And we partner with the place in Boston when that happens, but the vast majority of, let's say, laptop drives that are spinning fail within 3 years. And I typically can detect, based on the attributes I get from smart, whether or not the drive is aging or whether it's failing. And just because it passes smart doesn't mean that it's good. But if someone comes in complaining about something, there's a very high chance that it's a hard drive issue. And of course, it's a skewed statistic because the drives, the people that I'm seeing already have problems. They're not the general population. But of drives that I run into on a daily basis, and that's either on a running machine or ones that they brought in because they're external drives, if I can smart test it, I can usually figure out that the drive is failing as opposed to, oh, your file system is corrupt or Windows has a problem or OS X has a problem. Almost always, it's a hard drive issue. So that's sort of my general feeling. In our shop, we actually have a rule. Every computer, regardless of what's wrong with it, it could be a broken screen, we will smart test that drive. And we can usually do it in 3 minutes. It's not a big deal. We either pull it out or we boot off of a Linux USB or off of a Pixie boot. And every technician here is trained and required to implement smart testing on every drive that we encounter, regardless of the problem the person has. It's just part of our onboarding process.
Well, you know, one of the things that I always do when I bring a computer in the shop is I use Crystal Disk Info. Is one when I run my tool, which is most of the time D7.2, as soon as I load it up, that's the very first thing that pops up for me. So it gives, you know, and I like your idea because it gives you a good idea of kind of where the hard drive's at. You know, if the smart data is showing anything, or if you have any heating issues, bad sectors. It's not the end all of hard drive tools, but it's a very simple base, because a lot of times what I've done is I'll get a computer in, or in the past, this is what I've done. I pull a computer in and I'll go to do a virus removal because it's slow, it's not working right. And I'll, you know, be hours into a virus removal. And the next thing I know, I'm turning around going, something's still not right. And then I check the hard drive.
Yep. Yep.
And
I've been there.
Oh, yep, the hard drive's bad. So.
Yep. Totally. Yeah. That's actually the case. That's the scenario that we developed our system out of, because we were just like wasting time on stuff. Like, yeah, you have a virus, but you also have a failing drive. So maybe you should reconsider. And then, you know, you can offer them an alternative and
they don't
feel cheated.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I try to do my 5 minute diagnostic, unless it's a really weird issue. As a matter of fact, I just had a customer come in and he's like, I was sitting at my computer and I had some iced tea sitting next to it and I tipped it over and it fell and I kind of just wiped everything up. And, you know, now the keyboard, when I press the key, it does three key presses. And I'm like, because he had plugged it in on my table and everything. And I immediately go, this needs to be checked out thoroughly. I unplugged it, pulled the battery out. I'm like, how long ago was that? He's like, 10 days. I said, well, here's, okay, so a lot of people don't know. I said, when you spill something on a laptop, the spaces in between the keys, it will take the little channels going down all the way to your motherboard, and it's just like this little bead of water or liquid or whatever, and it goes to, it'll hit the hard drive, it'll hit the motherboard, it'll make a mess. And I said, that's not bad as long as you pull it, you know, pull the battery, don't turn it back on, get it to somebody, because now I've got to pull that whole thing apart and basically scrub it with alcohol.
Yep.
And
that's what we do in our shop. Exactly. That happens all the time.
So I said, okay, worst case scenario, I said, maybe because it's a little nicer laptop, they might have a barrier of sorts that stop it from leaking all the way down. I said, if it's leaked all the way down, I said, this thing needs to be pulled apart, scrubbed. And I said, you're probably going to end up replacing the keyboard at least. And so he's like, oh, okay. You know, so.
Yeah, I remember in the old days, or maybe even currently, ThinkPads would have those little tributaries or whatever. They would have little pathways that the liquid would flow around the motherboard. That was pretty cool.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I remember those. Yeah. You know, and it's, I'm surprised. Well, I know why they don't make them all like that, but yeah, I just wish people would never spill liquid on their
lap. It's we always get the wine on the MacBook and beer on the PC situation. Happens a lot. I've gotten throw up. I've gotten soup. You know, I've had, and more often than not, you can fix it. You find the failed component and you replace it, and it's okay. People think it's like the end of the world, and if you're willing to pay the money, you actually can get your machine back. So
yeah, the only one I've never been able to fix is, and this was because it sat for such a long time. Somebody had a cat that hopped up on their laptop and urinated all over it.
Oh my God. Oh yeah.
And the only, I'll be honest with you, this was not a regular customer. Cause if it was a regular customer, I would have just told him, nah, your computer's done. But it was for a friend. And he just said, hey, can you check it out? And I'm like, yeah, I'll check it out. So, you know, I got the rubber gloves on, and you know, of course that doesn't do a whole lot of good when you rip them on the sharp, you know, components on the motherboard, and he's exposed to it anyways. I looked at it. The urine had corroded so much of the motherboard. It was just like, no.
Oh, yeah. You really want to use that machine after that? I mean, it's, yeah.
Well, it was a MacBook, so.
It was expensive. Yeah, exactly. No, I get it. I mean, I'm talking to you on a X1 Carbon, and they're not MacBooks, but they're pretty expensive, and I keep as far as possible from anything liquid. So
yeah, exactly. I mean, I do keep a water. I've got a water on a separate table next to my desk that sits off.
Yes.
So it's not, you know, and really because I'm on a desktop, the worst case scenario is my cup would, you know, be knocked over and hit the keyboard, and that'd be about it. Of course, I mean, it's a $100 keyboard, so, you know, I really don't want to replace it. You know,
probably,
it's like,
right.
But, so anyways, so wow, we've really covered a lot of good information. We've talked about your co-op. We've talked about, did we talk about the business things that you do? Obviously you do data recovery, use a lot of Linux tools, system admin, both Windows and Linux. And then, Do you like go to businesses and support businesses, MSP type thing? Or
yes. So we basically are an MSP. We use remote support software and reporting software to sort of maintain and prevent problems at customer sites. I have a lot of clients. Off the top of my head, I can't think of. I would say I maintain around 80. But
okay, wow.
I've got a lot. As far as maintenance plans, we have less. A lot of our customers don't go for the maintenance plan, and that's something we're working on selling better.
Okay.
But like, essentially what happened is that we used to just have people prepay for hours, and then, you know, every 2 weeks I would go to a site for 3 or 4 hours and then go back, and we would do it that way. But what we would find is that it was hard to prevent problems because we had no reporting system in place to sort of, you know, see if a driver was going to fail or to do patch management and that kind of thing. So we spent a couple of months researching various remote management and reporting tools. And we ended up with a combination of tools that lead us to have that capability, but we're still selling it to clients now. Like we're just beginning now to push the MSP model a little more strongly. So that's sort of how that's kind of a point of I'm frustrated by the industry as a whole as far as being an MSP is concerned, because all the solutions, all the remote management and sort of integrated solutions for reporting and patch management suck, in my opinion.
Okay.
So we had to sort of cobble together a few different tools, and they're not perfect, but you know, they're better than the alternative. And I'm, when I say suck, I mean like they're either very costly, or they don't work in all the capacity that I need them to, or the interface is horrible. Like it depends. You name a tool and I'll tell you what's wrong with it.
Right.
But
right.
You know what? That's no one's fault. It's just we're small enough where the large scale tools don't make sense. So, you know, going with a huge Kaseya implementation or LabTech implementation doesn't really make sense for us. Something more along the lines of GFI or Continuum makes more sense, but neither of those really make us happy. Then again, LogMeIn Central is good, but it doesn't have the scripting that I need. And what we actually settled, and this is just a sort of a tangent, but we settled on one specific remote support tool called Screen Connect, which we host locally.
Okay, yeah, I've heard
and,
of it.
It's actually fan-freaking-tastic. It just doesn't do reporting. If they had a reporting extension, that thing would be the best tool I've ever used for what it is. Because you host it locally and you only pay for as many continuous sessions as you use. So it's very financially convenient, and it also is very customizable, and I get to host it and control it myself, which I love. But I'm very curious to know what other technicians have found works for them and why. And that includes ones that I've already sort of lambasted, like GFI. But so that's sort of one thing that we're working on right now, is rebuilding that portion of the business, the maintenance plan portion, which for us has been financially useful but sort of frustrating to support. And then on the other hand, a lot of the work that I do is replacing network hardware.
Okay.
A lot of our clients, the problems that they face are hardware related, like network infrastructure, so switches, routers, wireless devices, like access points. For example, I had helped a client recently who for months has been having exchange issues, and I could not figure out what the problem was, but for whatever reason, once in a while on Windows Outlook specifically, the outgoing email would be stuck in Outbox, and I don't know why, and none of the analyzer tools helped, and Microsoft couldn't help me, and they were telling me it was a firewall issue, which I thought it might be. Anyways, in the end, I replaced the hardware that they had sort of purchased before I became their support with these Edge Router Lights from Ubiquiti Networks, and they're these little $100 they're gigabit, but they have three separate 1 gigabit ports, so they can do up to 3 gigabits per second simultaneously. I replaced it with one of those. They're Linux-based routers. They're very customizable, very easy to use, and every single issue they had was resolved. All their QoS issues they had, all their outgoing exchange issues, their SPI issues, gone. And it's not just a change of hardware. They had a good Cisco firewall router and great Cisco switches, and they had pretty crappy access points, actually.
Okay.
Cisco actually. But long story short, sometimes replacing the hardware just solves the problem. So what I ended up deciding out of all this experience is that we need to start pushing hardware that works even when it's expensive. So if I go to a client and they're using a 5-year-old Linksys router, I'm not just going to replace it with a $140 Asus device that does wireless and routing. I'm going to replace it with a gigabit PoE switch, with Edge Router Lite, and with maybe a Ubiquiti access point, because quite frankly, it's a pain to manage all these firmware updates that are necessary for all the access points out there. And I can now manage all of my clients' access points from one controller on AWS that I can push out firmware updates when the latest security disaster happens, and I don't have to remote into their machine and then tell them, okay, I'm rebooting your router. I don't have to do any of that stuff. I can do it all remotely, and it freaking works. And the only downside is it's expensive. But I'm tired of using consumer tools to help businesses. It doesn't make sense. So that's... Yeah.
No, that's good. That's my philosophy too. I don't support a bunch of businesses right now. I still do mostly residential work because I do have a full-time job outside of this. But one of the things that I get from my clients all the time, because I do provide managed services for residential, And a lot of times people ask me when they come in for a virus removal, they'll go, well, how can I not get infected again? And I just have to tell them, I'm like, listen, I can set you up with an antivirus. I can set you up with some anti-malware tools that you can run, or you can buy a license and it'll run automatically. I said, but the reality is I can't stop you from clicking on things.
Damn straight. Yep.
And so the reality is you will get infected eventually again. I said, the only way I can prevent that is by doing a managed service where I check all your updates. I make sure that Java is updated. I make sure your Windows update is updated. I make sure that there's no hard drive issues. All these things are done. And then if you do get infected, we're going to remove that virus for free. Because you're already at a base where it's going to be very easy to go in and wipe that virus out. But when you don't, you're going to probably come back to me at least once a year.
Right.
I said, there's no way to avoid that.
They start to associate that recurring problem with you, and then they end up dropping you. That's my experience. And I totally agree with you. That's why we're pushing this sort of unlimited plan now, where we're responsible for this machine, and you're paying this much for this machine, and we're providing it with reporting and preventative maintenance. And if something happens, we bring it to the shop and swap it out and bring it back same day so that you know, your business can keep functioning. And we haven't really applied that to home, but I think the philosophy is the same. We're actually going to the point now where we're starting to host ESET Nod 32 and sell individual, like with our maintenance plans, we sell the antivirus as bundled as part of it. And it connects to our controller. So if they get an infection, we know about it immediately and we can go and wipe that machine and restore from an image. And that's kind of our that's our way of doing it. It makes us money, but it also provides them with antivirus that's covered in another maintenance plan. So it's the same idea.
Well, and that's the thing. Our maintenance plan, I mean, I use GFI Max.
Yeah.
Our maintenance plan provides the antivirus too, because I think we had this discussion. It might have been last week with a couple technicians where I said, for me, this is my opinion, to do a virus removal without a tune-up to me is almost criminal. And the reason I say
is because
by the time you end up removing a virus, even if you don't break any Windows systems or whatever, there are still things that are just not right. And you really need to go through. And my philosophy is I want that person to avoid getting this thing again. And, a lot of times I'll be doing a cleanup and I'll find, oh, there's the Trojan. It was a flash player.exe file. Okay.
Because they didn't have the latest flash version and they clicked on some pop-up because they didn't have
AdBlock. Exactly. Yeah. So, I know a lot of technicians that unless you pay for that service, they won't do it. And I'll give you another example, and I'm going to throw them under the bus because I can. Staples had this poor woman who's out of state come into their shop. She was at a hotel. She got infected. One of those fake antiviruses. She brings it in Staples. They charge her $149 and then to clean the viruses. And she's like, well, does everything work? Well, if you want a tune-up, that'll be another $50. But we don't think you need a tune-up. So she goes back to the hotel. Guess what? She still can't get online.
Oh, yeah. Probably her virus screwed up her.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, they don't. Yeah, you have to check. We have a checklist. We include tune-ups within virus removals, which we charge flat rate for. Yeah. We have a checklist. Does audio work? Does network work? Because when the person comes to pick up, their expectation is everything is as great as possible. And you can't always reach that, but you should aim for it. If you can proceduralize that, it's not that hard to do.
Exactly. And that's one of the philosophies that, I've always done. Now I used to do them for a lot cheaper than I do now, but, I learned from that they are kind of a big pain. So, because there's a lot to it, even though I don't spend that much time on keyboard anymore, everything is pretty much automated. I still have to go back every once in a while and touch a few things that are not automated.
Right. But, and you use D7, right?
Yep.
You mentioned So we use Techwaru, which they bought the D7 source code before he forked it.
Yep.
We're still just sort of playing, seeing if that will work for us. Our San Francisco branch uses it completely, but we're sort of still testing it out, because a lot of what it does, we actually have a guy who's a software developer in-house. So we were thinking, well, maybe we can do something ourselves and et cetera, et cetera. But it is pretty great. Like, but, I mean, it is just D7, but that's a great piece of software for automating virus removals. Do you guys you use CombiFix much?
I try to not use CombiFix unless I really have a serious problem.
Yeah.
Because CombiFix used in the wrong situations will definitely screw a computer
up. It's a weapon of power.
It is. And, you know, when you get to a certain point where something is absolutely still not working after you've done all the normal things that you would do to repair Windows, I'll either use CombiFix. Now, I can't remember. I don't believe CombiFix. I want to say it doesn't work in Windows 8.
It does not work in Windows 8.
Okay, so I've been using...
I'm sorry. It doesn't work in 8.1. It doesn't work in 8.1.
That's what it was. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
You know the guy who made it, Subs, he now works for Malwarebytes.
Okay.
He got hired by that, you know, that 26-year-old kid, whatever the right. guy was from Malwarebytes. I found this out. I was reading his AMA on Reddit, and he got hired, so I think, I'm not sure, but I think that their rootkit removal is basically a rebranded CombiFix, but I don't have any evidence for that.
Gotcha. Well, one of the other tools that I use when I have a stubborn Windows problem that I can't either isolate myself manually or any of the regular tools I've used, I'll use a Windows all-in-one repair tool. And that a lot of times has saved me from having to do anything. It resets all your proxies and
It saves you that time. Yeah, right.
You just run the program, you walk away, you let it do its thing, you come back, and hopefully the problem that you were having, whether Internet Explorer is not working or whatever, hopefully that will fix the problem.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, like we have a process, and we go through this process because we do it so damn much. I found that if after the fact there are a few things you can test for that usually are broken, you know, if a virus has loaded itself into a Windows driver and then you remove that virus, it'll sometimes break the driver. So sure. You just like test these things. But I remember once the sound wasn't working. I couldn't figure it out. And I ran CombiFix and the sound started working. And just like sometimes you just got to throw, you know, and CombiFix, it's such a crazy program. Like I remember many years ago, it was causing blue screens on XP machines. And so the guy who develops it, he took it down. And someone else put it up, and he sent them a DMCA takedown request, which I think the idea that this free tool, which is, you know, pretty notorious in the industry, that someone tried to post it, and this guy sent them a DMCA takedown. And no one even knows who that guy is. I love that
wow.
that whole universe of IT removal, that bleeping computer universe. I don't know. It's great to talk about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, a lot of great tools over there. Yeah, and as far as the tech USB with the TechWaru, again, a great tool. Those guys have really done a lot of stuff over there. I've interviewed those guys on a Podnets episode a little while back, and they're doing a lot of innovative stuff too. So
yeah, I wasn't terribly impressed with their live CD. I think Parted is far superior, and I don't trust, you know, a non-Windows version of CheckDisk. So that's all I have to say about that, but I am impressed with their USB tool. They're also from my hometown, so I'm...
Right, exactly. Oh, well, I tell you what, I think we have covered a bunch of information, and I would love to, if you want in the future, to come back on and talk about some things, because it sounds like you and I are very similar in our thought process, and probably even if your other guys want to come on or whatever and do an interview, that'd be
Charlie,
great.
Charlie is a great, he does all of our public stuff.
Okay, cool.
You know, we actually do a workshop every Thursday where we teach people about whatever topic that workshop happens to be, you know, not too technical. Usually it's for lay people, but we'll do, if someone asks about Linux data recovery, I'll do a workshop, but Charlie does it every week. And he is very public facing, so I would love to come back, but I think talking to him or one of our other techs is totally in the stars.
That would be great. Well, Yohai, I appreciate you. You definitely coming on the show. If people want to reach you, where's the best place to reach you at?
Well, obviously, email is easy for me. It's Yohai, Yochai, at bostontechcollective.com. You can also call the office. I've done a couple sort of cooperative related things on the internet that you might have might run across. I'm actually the moderator of, or I'm one of the moderators for our cooperatives on Reddit, which is like the, it's a sub just for cooperatives. And it's a pretty active sub as far as linking is concerned. So if you are interested in worker cooperatives, that's a great place to look. Otherwise, yeah, anyone who's interested in doing what we're doing, please reach out to me. I know a lot about this sort of thing. I've done it twice. So I can either point you to the right people, or even if you are interested in starting a similar thing, like another tech collective, we are planning on moving to New York. Not moving, but making a New York office eventually, and who knows where else. So happy to talk to anyone who wants to.
Great. Well, I appreciate it again, and you're more than welcome back. You guys can also find me on the Google Plus at Jeffrey Hallisch or Twitter at TechNutPC. And if you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, email me at podnutsdaily@podnuts.com. If you want to leave us a voicemail, which we'll play on the show, call 1-888-697-0162. And I want to thank our sponsors of the show, Instant House Call and D72. And don't forget, if you need business paperwork to get you started in your computer repair business, then check out the link for TechNibble Business Kit over at podnuts.com. Great kit to get you started in the regular paperwork that you'll use on a regular basis for your computer repair. You guys can also help support the Podnuts Network. The next time you're shopping at Amazon, go to podnuts.com/Amazon. And I want to thank everyone for listening and subscribing to the show. We'll see you next time on Podnuts Daily. My name is Jeff Hallisch. I am the host of Podnuts, where Chris Carruthers and myself take live calls on the air to answer questions or to get answers from other computer repair techs every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can check it out over at podnuts.com/live. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.